Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Impeachment inquiries are investigations into abuses of power in political office. In yesterday's first day of public hearings into the impeachment of President Trump, Vermont Democrat Congressman Peter Welch laid out the basic question.
The law prohibits any one of us here on the dais from seeking foreign assistance in our campaigns. The question for us is whether the use of power by the president was for the benefit of advancing his political interest in the 2020 campaign.
So did the president abuse his power? Well, Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik claims no, he did not.
For the millions of Americans viewing today, the two most important facts are the following. Number one, Ukraine received the aid. Number two, there was in fact no investigation into Biden.
We'll talk about claims and counterclaims yesterday, but also on display, something much deeper than partisanship, the decency and dignity required for government to function in the long term. And that decency has been under attack, too. In his opening statement, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent defended his fellow civil servants.
They all made the professional choice to serve the United States as public officials, helping shape our national security policy towards Russia in particular. And we and our national security are the better for it.
This hour on Point, what we learned in day one of public hearings in the impeachment of President Trump. And you can join us. Did you watch the hearings? What do you think is at stake? What are your questions? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me now is Elizabeth Holtzman. She was a four-term congresswoman from New York and a member of the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment investigation of President Nixon. She's also a former district attorney and comptroller for New York City and author of The Case for Impeaching Trump. Elizabeth Holtzman, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be with you and your audience.
And also with us today is Jonathan Turley. He's professor of public interest law at George Washington University. He testified as a constitutional expert in the Clinton impeachment hearings and was in favor of impeachment. He represented federal judge Thomas Porteous in his impeachment trial in 2010. Jonathan Turley, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna.
So, Elizabeth Holtzman, let me first start with you. You have been through this exact same process before as a member of Congress during the presidency of Richard Nixon. Do you think the Democrats were successful yesterday in laying out their argument for the impeachment of President Trump?
Well, I think they made a very good start in doing that. I think they brought two very distinguished diplomats to the table who explained very clearly the case that was that they were dealing with. They were alarmed. They were shocked. They were profoundly disturbed by the fact that the President of the United States had ordered a halt to military assistance and had refused to schedule a meeting with the President of Ukraine in order to bully Ukraine into conducting investigations into the 2016 presidential election and into the Bidens. And they thought that was a gross abuse of power. They'd never seen anything like it. And they themselves took action, at least one of them did, that was totally unprecedented in his, I don't know, decades of service to the U.S. government. He actually wrote a personal letter to the Secretary of State complaining about the situation. So I think that the Democrats had two very fine witnesses. It's a little bit esoteric and academic, but I think the public got a very clear sense of what the case is. There's much more to come. There are more facts to come out. But this was, I think, an important beginning. And I also think that for the most part, although there were some unfortunate exceptions, that the civility of the process was important. I think the American people deserve a dignified, serious review of this of the facts and of the law and the Constitution.
Well, let's hear from a moment from yesterday's public hearings. This is when Ambassador William Taylor, in his opening statement, he had noted that Ukraine is, in fact, in the middle of a hot conflict, a hot war with Russia right now. And he also talked about the fact that just last week he had visited Ukraine and a Ukrainian soldier was killed and 4 wounded just last week. And in summing up, he quoted his own September 9th text message to the U.S. ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland.
And finally, as the committee is aware, I wrote that withholding security assistance in exchange for help with a domestic political campaign in the United States would be crazy. I believed that then, and I believe it now.
Jonathan Turley, what did you make of yesterday?
Well, I certainly agree. I thought that the day was a good one for the Democrats. I think particularly Ambassador Taylor was the witness that the Democrats hoped Mueller would be. He was lucid, compelling, and he fully answered every question put to him. And in that sense, I think there's a great deal that came out of the hearing that was deeply disturbing to many of us. The question is whether the Democrats gained much ground towards impeachment. One can conclude from a hearing of this kind that the president may have acted in a contemptible way, but the question is whether he acted in an impeachable way. And the issue that concerns me most is that the Democrats, after spending 3 years saying that there were clear crimes established under Mueller, and there is a long list of these crimes, and after the Mueller hearings, the Democrats said, well, that established the record for these crimes. None of that apparently is going to be in this impeachment. And instead, we have this paradigm shift, and they're trying to go forward on just an abuse of power claim connected to the Ukrainian controversy. If they do that, it will be historically the narrowest impeachment in history. And they will do it on a largely undeveloped record. The Democrats have indicated that they want to vote by the end of the year. And this is after 3 years of really not making much progress towards impeachment, largely because Speaker Pelosi was known not to favor impeachment. But now there's a sort of pedal to the metal that we've got to move with such dispatch that they're not even going to go to court to force the testimony of people like John Bolton, the former national security advisor. And he could be quite devastating to the president. He obviously is in a position to have a more firsthand knowledge. And so the concern I have is that this is really building a collapsible impeachment. In architecture, there's a ratio of 1 to 10 in terms of height to width. As you go higher, you need a wider foundation. There's no higher structure in the Constitution to be built other than an impeachment. And this is a slender and narrow foundation. I don't see how this can survive in a Senate trial.
Well, Elizabeth Holtzman, I'll come back to you here in just a second, but I want to play another moment from yesterday's hearing because, you know, to this question of what exactly constitutes an impeachable offense within the context of the president's actions in Ukraine, just listen to this brief exchange between Democratic staff lawyer Dan Goldman and the Undersecretary of State, George Kent.
Mr. Kent, is pressuring Ukraine to conduct what I believe you've called political investigations a part of U.S. foreign policy to promote the rule of law in Ukraine and around the world?
It is not.
Is it in the national interest of the United States?
In my opinion, it is not.
Elizabeth Holtzman, I mean, respond to what Jonathan Turley's saying. He's saying that there's just a very, very narrow case here, and it could collapse.
Well, I don't know that the case will collapse. I don't agree with that. I think, in fact, as we go forward, there are many more fact witnesses who will simply amplify and extend and emphasize the points that have already been made. I do think he has one point in the sense of the American people need to put these facts into a context and understand why this is an impeachable offense, what the president has done. And I think part of the reason that didn't quite come out well enough in the hearing yesterday was that we have a bifurcated process taking place. the Intelligence Committee is really developing the facts. Then it will go to the House Judiciary Committee to draft and explain and propound articles of impeachment. That's where they will take the facts, put them in the constitutional context, and say why this is an impeachable offense. We kind of had that during a different situation, but it was similar in the Nixon impeachment. What happened there was that you had Senate Watergate hearings. They developed the facts. That was way before impeachment even started. So there was no need to explain why this information was important, what implications it had. They were just getting the facts out, and that's where John Dean testified that he told the president there was a cancer on the presidency. That didn't, at that point, lead to cries for impeachment. It was only the firing of the special prosecutor by Nixon that did. So it wasn't until we got to the Judiciary Committee and started debating the articles of impeachment that the whole framework, the impeachment framework, was put around the facts. So I think what's happening now is that people want – there needs to be kind of, in my judgment, some way of explaining the significance of what's happened for our democracy, not just for Ukraine, but for our democracy. And that hasn't happened. It's probably not going to happen in this proceeding, but we'll have to wait a little bit. I do think that the facts will show and will continue to show that President Trump abused his power by withholding the military aid. Now, the fact is, there could be more fact witnesses, but the president has firmly ordered that no one, and directed that no one in his administration should in any way, shape, or form cooperate.
Right.
That was an article of impeachment against Richard Nixon.
Stand by here for just a moment, and Jonathan Turley, hang in there as well. Time for our quick break, but we'll come right back. We're talking about what we learned in yesterday's first day of public hearings into the impeachment inquiry of President Trump. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what we learned in yesterday's first day of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Jonathan Turley. He's professor of public interest law at George Washington University. He testified as a constitutional expert in the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. Elizabeth Holtzman also joins us. She served as four terms in Congress representing New York and served on the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment inquiry into President Richard Nixon as well. Let's listen to a moment from Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik of New York. And she laid out the Republicans' argument that the president did not abuse his office, that he did nothing wrong, because in the end, two things did not happen.
For the millions of Americans viewing today, the two most important facts are the following. Number one, Ukraine received the aid. Number two, there was, in fact, no investigation into Biden. Mr. Kent and Ambassador Taylor, you both spoke eloquently and passionately about the need to support Ukraine to counter Russian aggression, particularly during this very critical time. I agree with you in that assessment. And isn't it the case that the Trump administration has indeed provided substantial aid to Ukraine in the form of defensive lethal aid, correct?
That is correct.
And that is more so than the Obama administration, correct?
The Trump
defensive
administration?
Lethal aid.
Yes.
That's Congresswoman Elise Stefanik speaking to Ambassador Bill Taylor there. Okay, so they're saying that the aid went through, but of course that happened after the whistleblower filed their complaint. And so here's how Democratic Congressman Joaquin Castro of Texas took on the Republican defense that no wrongdoing happened because the aid did eventually go through.
Is attempted murder a crime? Is attempted murder a crime?
Attempted murder is a crime.
Is attempted robbery a crime?
Neither of us is a lawyer, but
I think anybody in this room could answer that question.
I think that's right. I'll go out on a limb and say, yes, it is.
Is attempted extortion and bribery a crime?
I don't know, sir.
Jonathan Turley, help us understand something. I mean, you said before the break that you think there's a very narrow foundation here for the Democrats, but I mean, the U.S. law, the U.S. code says very clearly that people are prohibited from accepting or soliciting anything of value from a foreign government to influence a U.S. election. I mean, the acceptance of the thing of value doesn't have to have happened. The solicitation seems to be enough, according to our own law. Why is that? Why does that not apply in this case? It should apply.
Well, the fact is you do not need a crime for impeachment, but you do need clarity. And there is a lack of clarity on the details here. The federal law also says that the president has discretion to withhold military aid. And Chairman Schiff has argued that they may present a bribery article of impeachment along the lines of what you've just suggested. And his argument is that bribery meant something different back in the period of the Constitution's drafting. It was a broader concept. I thought it was a little ironic because Adam Schiff, who was my opposing counsel during the last impeachment trial, is something he believes in a living constitution. So he seems to have converted himself into an originalist on this point. But fortunately for him, he's wrong. The history does not support a broader definition of bribery for these purposes. Indeed, there was a debate during the Constitutional Convention, including an exchange between Mason and Madison. Mason objected that treason and bribery were too narrow and wanted to include a thing called maladministration to broaden the meaning. This is not bribery, and it's not extortion. I don't think that they'll be able to make that case. The problem that they're going to have is to create a limiting principle if they're going forward just on an abuse of power claim. Usually abuse of power claims can be the basis for articles of impeachment, but they go forward with other in a broader context, particularly other issues that would be crimes. To just go up in abuse of power, it demands a limiting principle. I suspect that if you had a transcript of all the conversations of President Obama, President Clinton, President Kennedy, LBJ, you would find many of them made references to political considerations. So the question then is, how do we define this impeachable offense? Contemptible is not synonymous with impeachable. So how do you define it here? Because all politicians are self-dealers. Everyone in that committee room is a self-dealer. They all use their offices to advance their interests. And so we have to come up with a limiting principle if they're going to proceed on this very narrow basis.
Well, so Elizabeth Holzman, let me ask you then, as Jonathan Turley is saying, it sounds like what Professor Turley is saying is that in addition to the limiting principle that the Democrats need to be able to draw a very bright line connecting the president to the withholding of aid. But as you pointed out, the White House is preventing people who have firsthand knowledge of what happened from testifying. And every time GOP members of Congress are asked about that, they say, well, that's a longstanding principle of the White House and that we have a court case currently pending to see who might be compelled to testify, et cetera. Well, I mean, is that obstruction? Does that fact in and of itself constitute enough obstruction to move forward on that charge?
Yes. I want to make several points. First of all, with regard to obstruction, that was an article of impeachment against Richard Nixon. And by the way, the Nixon proceedings that were voted, the articles voted by the House Judiciary Committee and the proceedings were the gold standard. And that's the only time we've ever had a president removed directly as a result of impeachment proceedings. So the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon included an article specifically charging him with obstructing the activities of the committee in its impeachment inquiry. And why is that important? Because the impeachment power was put into the Constitution, I think Professor Turley understands this very well, in order to protect our democracy. And to protect our democracy specifically against a rogue president. If the president stonewalls and refuses to cooperate and directs others not to cooperate, and we saw that in the hearing itself, the notes that these two witnesses had were not turned over to the committee, preventing his administration from turning over notes of witnesses. All of this is a profound assault on the Constitution and the central power to check presidential misconduct. So I have no problem. That's not a narrow issue at all. It's a broad issue, and it goes to the survival of our democracy. Secondly, with regard to the issue about, well, this is narrow, this is broad, the point of it, let's go back to the Nixon impeachment. What was the cover-up about? Nixon's cover-up of the Watergate burglary involved his misuse of the powers of his office in order to get reelected. The 72 election was coming up. A break-in took place in June. It had to be covered up so that Nixon could be reelected. So you had a president using the power of his office, pardons, hush money, so forth, in order to get reelected at any cost. What do we have with regard to Trump? Trump misusing the powers of his office to force a foreign country to help him get reelected. Getting reelected at any cost. We have an interference in the electoral process by a president of the United States that is a profound abuse of power and a profound threat to democracy. And by the way, you don't have to have a dead body. You don't need to have a fulfilled crime. For example, one of the articles of impeachment, one of the grounds for it was Richard Nixon ordered and directed audits, harassing audits by the IRS of political opponents, people who supported McGovern or supported the peace movement, anti-Vietnam War movement. That was a ground for impeachment, even though the IRS refused to conduct a single audit. And if you want to go into how something wasn't accomplished, yes, one of the key factors that resulted in Nixon's impeachment was that he ordered the CIA to stop the FBI's investigation. But guess what? While the CIA did do that, ultimately all the burglars were caught, prosecuted, and Nixon himself was named an unindicted co-conspirator. So, yes, the fact of the matter is they tried to obstruct, but in the end, people were prosecuted for that cover-up.
Right.
So, yes, you can say, well, you know, there was a prosecution, so forget that Nixon tried to stop it. But that wasn't what happened. Nixon was the House Judiciary Committee voted for his impeachment for the cover-up, wasn't ultimately successful, and he would have been removed and convicted in the Senate. Oh. So I think the argument is just a nonsense argument, and it's not going to hold any water here. The fact of the matter is the president, President Trump, used the power of his office to try to bully a foreign government into interfering with our democratic elections in the U.S.
If I could respond.
Please, go ahead, Professor Turley.
I have tremendous respect for Liz. We've spoken together before. But I think this is the problem we had for the last 3 years, is that you can overstate the evidence. For the last 3 years, we've heard various members on that committee say that they had established and clear crimes that have all but evaporated. None of them are included. I would be more comfortable with a broader impeachment. But I think part of the problem that I have as a scholar is that the claims being made here parallel, in my view, what we've seen for the last 3 years. And that, yes, it is true that notes were withheld from these witnesses. I'm concerned about that as well. But the White House is entitled to challenge, on basis of executive privilege, for example, the testimony of core witnesses. What the White House is not allowed to do is to disobey a court order. And so the Obama administration regularly refused witnesses to Congress, including on investigations like Fast and Furious. The Democrats supported those refusals. And many of us said that the Obama administration had every right to go to court and have a judge determine whether that was an appropriate assertion. You cannot at this stage claim that it's obstruction when the Democrats are saying they don't have time to go to court and to get judicial review. So I just feel that that type of obstruction argument is going to be quite weak. The other thing about abuse of power here is also the timeline. You know, the one clear thing that came from Ambassador Taylor was that we know when the Ukrainians found out about the quid pro quo. They found out on August 29th, and Taylor confirmed that and said right after the political story ran that said there was a quid pro quo, mm-hmm. he got a call immediately from the Ukrainians basically saying, what the heck is this? It was 11 days later that the military aid was released. And so, you know, you have an 11-day period here. Now, does that mean that the president acted appropriately? No, it certainly doesn't. But the question is that enough? That is a quid pro quo that the Ukrainians weren't aware of. They didn't do the investigation requested. They didn't do the statements requested. Is that enough? Now, I happen to agree with the Democrats, and particularly Chairman Schiff, when at the end he said, don't forget that they released this aid 48 hours after it became known that the whistleblower complaint was given to Congress. I thought that was a very powerful point, and it undermined the Republican narrative. But I'm not too sure that it defeats it.
But Professor Turley, let me ask you something. You say,
can I just respond, though, please?
Can I ask Professor Turley a quick question, and then I'll turn back to you, Congresswoman Holtzman. But you say, is that enough? I mean, if you're acknowledging that certain things did happen, that aid was withheld and that was only released because a whistleblower filed a report, why isn't that enough? I mean, you're not challenging the assertion that aid was withheld in exchange for the demand of an investigation.
No, I'm saying that I'm perfectly willing to believe. I think the Democrats made a powerful case that there was an understanding of a quid pro quo. The question is that something impeachable or contemptible? And I know it's contemptible. It's where it's impeachable that I'm a little bit concerned, that I don't see how we can define the impeachable standard on these current facts. I mean, it'd be different if in the coming hearings we hear about people trying to suborn perjury or clear acts of obstruction. But the problem with what was said earlier, that, well, this really isn't about impeachment, it's about the facts, we'll hear more in the judiciary hearing, we're going to hear very little. You know, the Democrats have made it clear that they are going to really speed this through and get a vote by the end of December. We don't expect many hearings out of this. And that's part of the problem. You're absolutely right. Nixon was the gold standard. But Nixon allowed the public to catch up. There was a maturation and saturation that came with it. The question is, why suddenly the Democrats want to move quickly? Mm. And the schedule cannot be the Iowa caucuses. Okay. You know, it needs to be the development of an impeachment case.
Well, Elizabeth Holtzman, let me turn back to you. But I also just want to note that Professor Turley, I hear you moving between sort of legal and constitutional and political considerations here. And that's you know, they overlap a little, but they're all not the same. But Elizabeth Holtzman, I know you want to respond, so go ahead.
Yes, I want to respond to a number of things. First of all, Ambassador Taylor said from his point of view, the Ukrainians found out on August 29th. But there's substantial information, probably will come out later, that they learned a lot earlier, and it wasn't on August 29th. So let's just take that fact and hold that in abeyance. But I want to go back to the issue of the attempt to the stonewalling of Congress in the impeachment inquiry. Fast and furious and Obama inquiries, that's one thing. We're talking about an impeachment inquiry. Let's go back to what happened during Nixon. The House Judiciary Committee, under the chairmanship of Peter Rodino, refused to go to court to seek any subpoenas or any enforcement because under Article 1, it was his view and basically the committee's view, under Article 1 of the Constitution, the House of Representatives has the sole power of impeachment. And so a court can't tell us what information we're entitled to or we're not entitled to. That was a position that was taken in the House Judiciary Committee then. And Nixon, we didn't issue a we issued subpoenas, but we never went to court to get a determination as to whether Nixon was required to turn those documents over. So I strongly disagree with your view about that, and certainly the history is very relevant here. Secondly,
well, Elizabeth
Holtzman,
it's
11 days.
I've just got to jump in here because we've got 30 seconds before you got to get into a break. So I'll let you pick up the thought when we come back. Elizabeth Holtzman and Jonathan Turley join us today. We're talking this hour about what we learned in yesterday's first day of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry. We'll also take a couple of calls when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what we learned in yesterday's first day of public hearings in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. Jonathan Turley joins us today. He's a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. He testified as a constitutional expert in the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, and he also represented four former U.S. attorneys general during the Clinton impeachment litigation. Elizabeth Holtzman joins us. She served four terms in Congress representing New York. And she was on the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment inquiry into President Richard Nixon. And Congresswoman Holtzman, you were making a couple of points before the break, so go ahead.
Yes, I just want to add quickly that, first of all, there's a serious question as to whether Professor Turley said the president has a right to withhold military assistance. There's a serious question as to whether he violated the Budget and Empowerment Control Act of 1974, an act that was written in direct response to President Nixon's efforts to stop funding of various poverty programs. These weren't for his electoral, it wasn't directly to get information to use in an election, but it was, as a result of that, Congress passed laws to make it basically to control any effort by a president not to spend money. Part of the president's refusing to let any people from the budget office come down and testify. But on the face of it, you can draw the inference that the law was violated here. So President Trump violated, and if he doesn't produce the evidence contrary to that, I think you can fairly conclude that President Trump violated that law. But I don't think we need to even get a violation of a law, whether it's a crime or not a crime, because I think at the core is what we – the abuse of power here is very grave, which is the president used the power of his office withholding military aid for the purpose of getting a foreign country to intervene in our election. And undermining our election by misusing his powers is a serious abuse and a threat to our democracy, which is really what the abuse of power has to amount to. It's not just any abuse of power. It's an abuse of power that threatens our democracy. And that's what we have here, and it's akin to Nixon.
Can I just make one limited I must disagree with what was said about the clarity again, but I just want to note one thing, and that is what was said about the Rodino position. And as Liz said, they said, you know, our position on the committee was that, quote, no court could tell us what information we were entitled to. Well, that's wrong. That's fundamentally wrong. Article 1 does not give Congress the sole authority over information. That's why we have the courts. There's conflicts that occur. That's exactly what people have legitimately criticized Trump for, that he often acts like Article 2 is the beginning and end of all conflicts. We have a court system. The president's entitled to go to court, and he did in the Nixon case. There was judicial review.
But not of what the House Judiciary Committee did. We didn't go to court. We never went to court.
But there was judicial – there's ultimately judicial review. But the statement that no court can tell you what evidence you can demand is simply not true. You're not an island in the Constitution. It's shared powers. And this is not to defend what President Trump has done. I've written columns after column, you know, criticizing Trump, including his failure to cooperate. But he has also turned over information. He's waived a lot of executive privilege. I don't think you can make out a case for obstruction on this record.
Elizabeth
Holtzman? Well, I think
Holtzman?
You can. I think it's very clear. And it's not only clear in this case, but when you undertake, as President Trump has, a thoroughgoing assault on the impeachment process by forcing his aides not to turn documents and evidence over, that's a profound assault on the process. And it's not just the Judiciary Committee. Remember, the committee itself has to act, has to have approval from the whole House of Representatives, and then there's a two-thirds vote in the Senate. So there are plenty of checks on the impeachment process itself. It's not unilateral the way Donald Trump is behaving, and not by any means. And I think his stand on undermining and trying to destroy the impeachment power, which is really what he's trying to do, is an outrage and a real danger to the Constitution, because in the end, what other check do we have?
Well, let me just play a couple of more moments. Let me play a couple more moments from yesterday's hearing, and then I want to get at least a couple of calls in here. First of all, on the question of the big question of impeachment itself, there was this interesting moment where Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe of Texas, he was questioning Ambassador Bill Taylor about whether Taylor believes there were impeachable offenses in that now infamous call between President Trump and the Ukrainian president. There's a lot of back and forth here. Chairman Adam Schiff, ultimately made space to allow Bill Taylor to answer the question. And they struggle over the rules a little bit, Ratcliffe and Schiff do, but here's how it resolves.
Suspend the time,
Ambassador
please.
Taylor, suspend would you like time, to answer please. The question?
Suspend the time, please. I withdrew the question.
The gentleman will suspend. We will suspend the clock.
Suspend the clock
suspend
at
the clock.
1 minute, please.
Ambassador Taylor, would you like to respond to the question?
Mr. Ratcliffe, I would just like to say that I'm not here to do anything having to do with to decide about impeachment. That is not what either of us are here to do. This is your job.
So deciding about impeachment is the job of members of Congress, says Ambassador Bill Taylor. Now, President Trump yesterday, while all this was going on, he was in a meeting with the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in a joint press conference with the Turkish president. Here is what President Trump had to say.
I haven't watched for 1 minute because I've been with the president, which is much more important as far as I'm concerned. This is a sham and shouldn't be allowed. It was a situation that was caused by people that shouldn't have allowed it to happen. I want to find out who is the whistleblower. because the whistleblower gave a lot of very incorrect information, including my call with the president of Ukraine, which was a perfect call and highly appropriate.
That's the president yesterday. In fact, much of what the whistleblower had written in their complaint has been subsequently corroborated by witnesses who have given depositions to Congress. Let's go to DJ, who's calling from Richmond, Virginia. DJ, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am.
Go ahead.
All right. Yesterday, I learned that the commander cannot withhold military aid to advance personal interests. There was a question, the last question that was posed at the end of the hearing, where the answer was given that it would be wrong for the commander to withhold aid to the military for personal interest, enlightened me and educated me to the fact that if you're in possession of something with the intent to, let's say, extort or bribe, as it's being put it, I find that, you know, that that's something that has to be considered.
Mm. Well, DJ, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Robert, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi. So for Professor Turley, you were testifying on the Clinton impeachment, and you said just now today that this the impeachment charges seem so narrow to you. You said too narrow. Yet in 1998, Bill Clinton was impeached. I know there were two articles of impeachment, but he was impeached pretty much essentially solely because of the reason that he lied on a deposition about having consensual sex with a competent adult who's not his wife. That is solely why Bill Clinton was impeached. And yet this corruption that we're just, this blatant corruption that we're seeing now, the broad and widespread corruption is too narrow?
Jonathan Turley, go ahead.
Robert, it's a fair question. I've written actually columns comparing the previous impeachments, and I've actually said that the Clinton impeachment was one of the narrow impeachments. Indeed, that's part of the problem that I flagged on this one. I think that it has the same flaws we saw with Clinton and Johnson. Both were very narrow. This is closer to Johnson, which had 11 articles, but they're all based basically on the Tenure of Office Act violations alleged in the removal of the war secretary. But what is different with Clinton is that Clinton was based on a crime. I mean, he committed perjury. And when we had that testimony, the issue was, does it matter if you commit perjury what the subject was? It doesn't, in my view. Your reference to the fact that he lied about an affair does not matter to me. You cannot lie under oath as president of the United States. I feel that way with any president. And a federal judge later found that he did lie under oath. That's an act of perjury people have gone to jail for. So, yes, there were just two articles, but one of them was an alleged crime that a federal court later amplified and said was committed when he lied under oath. So it's not that the Clinton impeachment was wider. It was not. But they're proceeding in this case with a pure abuse of power claim. And this goes to what DJ was raising before, and that is what Trump will argue is that he was asking not for a finding against the Bidens, but investigations. And he was, his position is going to be that just as the Obama administration approved investigations into the unfolding 2016 elections, he was asking in his administration for an investigation as to what happened through Ukraine. And we can all, you know, agree or disagree whether that was valid or not. But he asked for plural investigations. And one of those investigations dealt with matters currently under investigation by John Durham. So he's going to argue that he was asking for cooperation with an existing investigation. Now, we're putting aside the reference to the Bidens, which are very problematic. But one of those investigations, I don't think you can allege, are impeachable because presidents have asked other countries to assist with ongoing investigations at the Department of Justice. And John Durham is looking at Ukraine as well as other issues related to 2016.
Elizabeth Holtzman, let me ask you something. I mean, I hear Professor.
I want to respond to that, too.
I do. I'll let you respond. But I just want to, for those of us who don't have sort of encyclopedic knowledge of case law, of constitutional case law, it does seem as if Professor Turley sort of holding up a standard here that a president's actions have to rise to the level of definable criminal activity in order to be impeachable. But I
no, I did not say that. I said the opposite. I said you don't need a crime, but you do need clarity.
Okay, so I guess maybe what I'm asking is how much corruption can a society tolerate in its president before we say we have enough clarity for this to be impeachable? And Elizabeth Holtzman, I'll just turn that to you.
Well, my view is that there's a substantial amount of clarity. I'm not disagreeing with Professor Turley that I think that it couldn't be expanded. I think there are other acts that he's engaged in that are extremely serious, meaning President Trump. But I think two things about this. Number one is that somehow, Professor Turley, even though you say you don't believe that the commission of a crime is necessary for impeachment, you really come down strongly on the idea that because President Clinton lied under oath, and we have a finding by a federal judge, but okay, that's the case, not every crime is impeachable. We also established that in the Nixon impeachment. There was serious question about Nixon's taxes. We looked at the taxes, and it was sketchy, to say the least, and probably violated the law. But you know something? We did not, even though I voted for that impeachment article, the committee did not vote for it because it did not rise to the threat to our democracy. Yes, it was an abuse of the power, and it didn't even involve the abuse of the powers of his office. So in retrospect, the committee did the right thing, even though the taxes were a serious issue. The same with regard to Clinton. In my view, he did not use the powers of his office. His conduct was completely reprehensible and inexcusable. But consider, I think the gentleman raises exactly the right point. What is a threat to our society when a president uses the powers of his office, not his mouth, but the powers of his office, the huge, awesome powers of his office, to bully a fledgling, fragile democracy into interfering with an election? And if you think, by the way, that what Trump was trying to get was a quote-unquote factual answer, you've got something else. You put something into your pipe and smoking it that is not quite legit. Because as Alexander Vindman said in his testimony, Ukraine is not a mature democracy. They don't have a particularly good criminal justice system, one that can find facts. So to look for Ukraine to come up with the quote-unquote truth, this was going to be a truth that suited Donald Trump. And don't think for one minute that if they came up with the truth that he didn't like, he'd say, well, go back again and look harder. Mm. I mean, I think the idea that he was looking for truth here is beyond, it's just incredible. He wanted dirt on his opponents. And the other thing he was trying to do, the CrowdStrike, was to undo the Mueller. It was right. Delegitimize the Mueller report.
Elizabeth Holtzman, you're just going to have to give me a chance to let Jonathan Turley respond to this. And Professor Turley, we've only got a minute and a half left. We could talk for hours. But one thing I do want to just emphasize is that yesterday we heard, and in previous statements from Ambassador Taylor and Kent as well, that they both recognize what they call irregular policy channels that were operating or even poisoning actions in the Ukraine against the best interests of the United States. To Elizabeth Holtzman's point, how is that not an abuse of presidential power?
It can be. There's lots of abuses of presidential power. The question is, which of those abuses rise to the level of impeachment? I want to clarify a couple of things. First of all,
you got to do it in 45 seconds, Professor. I'm so sorry.
First of all, what I'm saying is that you don't need a crime, but if you don't have a crime, then you need added clarity and added definition. I think it's a tad convenient to say, oh, well, not all crimes are impeachable, thus Clinton shouldn't be impeached. But this vague concept of abuse of power, even if it's not criminal, should be impeachable. We have to define that better if you're going to try to remove a sitting president. And I'm not saying you can't, but I'm saying that it's your burden to do so.
Well, Professor Jonathan Turley is a professor of public interest law at George Washington University. He testified as a constitutional expert during the impeachment hearings of President Bill Clinton. Professor Turley, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Holtzman, she served for four terms in Congress representing New York, and she served on the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment inquiry into President Richard Nixon. Congresswoman Holtzman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.